Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So did you guys see the big news this week that Melania Trump has unveiled what her signature initiative will be should she become our first lady?
I gotta say, I thought it was a joke when I read it.
My breath is bated. What is it?
She is going to focus as first lady on issues related to cyberbullying.
Wow. Yeah,
and she's going to start at home.
Yeah, good luck
with
that. I mean,
maybe that is, right? Maybe it's like her pointed... you know, critique of Trump.
Yeah, this
of
is
her own
brilliant.
Husband.
She's going to say she's going to roll out the campaign. She's going to be like, "But anti-bullying education starts in the House, including the white one."
Yeah, that's nice. You can come up with all sorts of good slogans for this. But meanwhile, because the election is rigged, they're not going to actually be in the White House.
Oh, yeah.
The rootless cosmopolitan international bankers are getting together with the international media to, you know, keep them out.
And I just came from our
meeting, with all the
actually.
Black people who were dead in Philadelphia who were going to vote.
Yeah.
Are they out there with the Trilateral Commission? The Bilderberg?
We've been reanimating their corpses to make sure we can get them to vote
Every damn conspiracy theory, like, you think is some weird Bircher
fluoridated water.
Yeah, exactly. Black
helicopters.
Is sort of showing up in the Trump campaign.
Oh.
I'm going to be sad when it's all over.
I am not at all.
I'm not weeping.
Hello and welcome to Rational Security, the Thank God We're Not in Kansas Anymore edition. I'm Shane Harris of The Daily Beast. It feels like June here in lovely October.
Yeah, it's jungly in our jungle studio.
It sure is. I feel like we're like going back in time. Remember before the nomination? Can we just like relive it all again?
No.
Wouldn't you love to go back to June?
Oh, kill me now.
We still had to talk about Ted Cruz.
Yeah, remember those? Remember that guy? Yeah, those days seem so long ago.
They do seem long ago. What else seems long is that like the whole Trump video thing a week ago.
Yeah, it was only a week ago.
Not a month. Not a year.
As a friend of mine commented on a podcast this week, we were so innocent then. Well, we're here in the studio with my good friends Tamara Kaufman-Wittes, Ben Wittes, and Susan Hennessy. Hi, guys.
Hey, Shane.
Big week. We're not going to actually get to talk about debates at the top of the podcast because there's one tonight. We're recording this on Wednesday.
The last one.
By the time you listen to this, everything we're talking about will be irrelevant because we will only be talking about...
Whatever conspiracy theory Trump puts out.
The latest outrage from the debate. So this is like, consider this podcast almost like a time capsule of the period of your innocence when the third debate had not happened yet.
But that's what we're here for. We're here to highlight the important stories that the rigged media won't cover.
That's right. That's right. Well, we've rigged up gotten together a great slate of stories for you here today. Iraqi and U.S. forces begin the campaign to reclaim the city of Mosul, ISIS's de facto capital in Iraq. Retired General James Cartwright pleads guilty to lying to federal leak investigators. And three Kansas men are accused of plotting attacks on Muslims, plus object lessons. Why don't we start with the campaign to take back Mosul, which obviously is we were anticipating for some time, even though Donald Trump said we should launch a sneak attack. We'll try to make this a Trump-free podcast as much as possible.
Please, God.
But so the campaign has begun with Iraqi forces in the lead, taking a number of villages on the outskirts of Mosul right now, and then the plan is eventually that Iraqi counterterrorism units, which are their elite force, will start to go in fight for Mosul. Tamara, why don't you start with me talking about, you know, that we've gone through the lead up to this, but do you want to talk a bit about both the significance of taking Mosul and the challenges that you think they're going to face and anything else you think is significant now that we're in this campaign that, you know, probably will last, I would imagine, well past the election and maybe into the next administration?
Right. So President Obama's war against ISIS, which started just over 2 years ago, began with sending U.S. military advisors back into Iraq to help rebuild the Iraqi army's counterterrorism capability. So this is, in many ways, the first big test of that effort, the Iraqi counterterrorism force and Iraqi army units going in to take back this territory leading up to Mosul, and then they're going to have to fight probably building to building or even house to house to take the city. There are a few things I think worth watching as this rolls out. Obviously, the performance of Iraqi forces is one, but they are, in fact, getting help from the United States, although our Pentagon insists that our own personnel are well back from the front line. Also from Kurdish forces who are simultaneously attacking from Erbil to the east of Mosul. And there is the question of Shia militias and what role they're going to play in this campaign as it goes forward. But for right now, the Iraqi army is in the lead. A couple things to keep our eyes on, and I think this campaign is probably going to take a couple months because they are apparently ISIS has heavily mined and booby-trapped the territory outside Mosul, and so it's going to take a while to move forward. There are still a lot of civilians inside the city. ISIS has blocked people from leaving, although we have begun to see some flows out both to the east or Kurdish territory and also now Iraqi refugees going into Syria. Like, that tells you something about how bad it's been under ISIS rule that these Iraqis are fleeing into a civil war.
Amazing.
To get away from where they've been. So the humanitarian side, I think, is going to be a tremendous challenge for the international community, for the Iraqis, the Kurds, and the UN agencies operating in Syria. But the other dimension is what happens on the other side. When Mosul is eventually taken, and I think there's every reason to believe it will be, if nothing else, ISIS can just melt away and fight as an insurgency, and we've seen that before. But who will govern Mosul? How will that be structured? What will be the balance between rule from the central government in Baghdad, which is Shia-led, and a lot of Iraqi Sunnis do not trust, and local governance? The local Mosul government that was there before ISIS took over probably doesn't have this, you know, the legitimacy that one would hope. And so if you want to keep ISIS out or any extremists out of this predominantly Sunni town, you have to make sure that the governance you replace ISIS with is effective and legitimate in the eyes of the local population. And frankly, that's a tough one for this Iraqi government.
And do we know anything about what the Iraqi government has planned in that regard?
I think the biggest problem right now is just that there's a lack of clarity. I think the default would be for the previously extant Mosul council to be reinstated. And for the civilians that have been living under ISIS rule all that time while their leadership had fled, I'm not sure that's going to be acceptable.
I mean, one sort of interesting dimension is what happens when you remove the common enemy from a group of people, right? You have groups that do not necessarily have aligned interests, have sort of deep suspicions among them, but have sort of been united against this common threat of ISIS. And when you take away kind of the one thing you have in common, which is this oppositional force, what you can find to replace that, right? It sort of seems like it has to be a common purpose or splitting things up. Is there any sort of concern that once sort of ISIS is purged, just the infighting becomes sort of whoever's the strongest force ends up winning? What sort of
the
fear?
Isn't that the story of Iraq in a way? I mean, ever since the U.S.-led surge kind of put a damper on the Iraqi civil war, that's been precisely the challenge. Is do people then just devolve to tribal or sectarian allegiances or whoever's got the money? You know, or whoever's got goodies to give away then becomes the top dog and everybody else then tries to claw them down and become king of the hill.
One of the things I wondered about this campaign is, you know, how hard of a fight does ISIS put up? Because there have been sometimes where, and you mentioned this before, they kind of melt away, they become insurgents. The Wall Street Journal actually had a story this week that sort of in the middle of the piece quoted a anonymous ISIS commander saying that the plan actually is to try and move their forces out and retreat back to Syria and, you know, where they feel like they're more protected. Let's just
say that they point out that it's weird that the Wall Street Journal is sourced in ISIS.
And no, but a lot of Western journalists have sources in ISIS, and these are very English proficient guys that they WhatsApp with or text with or whatever.
Yeah, I think it was a Skype interview or something.
I know. I just think it's weird. I'm not
saying that's what journalists do.
I'm not saying it's not good journalism. I'm not, but it's like sources in ISIS.
Everything. Our source is an anonymous mid-level commander in ISIS.
Right, exactly.
Like, just give me a fake name. I mean, no one knows. But it raised this question. I was talking about this with a colleague this week saying, okay, let's just say that they retreat and they say, forget it, we're pulling out. Does it just send a message then to its followers, we no longer have a caliphate, or we've given up part of the caliphate? Do you have to change the name? There's no longer, you know, Iraq in the name of ISIS or Daesh, however you want to talk about it. I mean, what do you think? I mean, if they were to pull away, does that just spell a huge does it embarrass them greatly in front of the followers they're trying to attract?
Well, so I think this is something that the counter-ISIS coalition is playing up, that we're going to make sure they lose their territory, so they lose their claim to a state, and that's going to be just a huge blow to their appeal. I don't know how well that's going to play out in practice. I think, number one, we've already seen a dynamic whereby ISIS, when it loses territory, looks for out-of-area operations. So it very well could presage increased attempts to attack in, for example, European cities or in the United States, or in other more, you know, vulnerable soft targets. But the other thing is that ISIS is already kind of shifting its propaganda around precisely this issue in anticipation of this campaign, and saying that, you know, and also the loss of Dabiq, in Syria, which they lost last week. So they're basically arguing that the caliphate exists. It exists in our hearts. It exists in our bodies, in our movement. Whether or not it exists in a particular town is not relevant. And in the long run, you know, we will triumph. The end of the world is at hand, and you have to have faith in the prophecy. So I think they're already, as good ideologists do, tacking to adjust to reality, and they've got a lot of tools to work with.
Do you think people who will, I mean, I haven't heard this, but I could imagine some people might imagine that the Obama administration did this in the final months as sort of a, you know, a gift to Hillary Clinton or something like this. I mean, is there, what do you make of the timing of this? And I mean, and it seems that it's going to get handed off, right, to whoever the next person is. So should they have waited? I mean, is there, you know, are there people who are going to claim this was politically? And I ask that because, of course, we claim everything is a conspiracy.
Well, because it's rigged, Shane. We know this.
The fight against ISIS is rigged.
Yes, everything. Everything is political and everything is rigged. Just take it for granted. But honestly, like, this fight against ISIS is not going to be over even if Mosul falls tomorrow. And by the way, even if Mosul falls tomorrow, that doesn't mean Mosul is going to be stabilized and, you know, for sure going to remain under Iraqi government sovereignty.
I mean, if anything, you would sort of expect that this is a risky PR move. I think even the New York Times and others have reported that the decision to go now was a sort of an Iraqi-led timeline. What's interesting is that the messaging to the public, right, both the American public and sort of the public, sort of the global public, about what's going to happen, right? This is, you know, protracted urban warfare. This is not a I think people have become sort of accustomed to these ideas of sort of special operations forces moving in the dark of night, and then by the next morning it's all over. That this is something that's very different, that's very messy, it's really complex. You have lots of civilians mixed in with people. You know, there, I haven't seen a lot of sort of expectation setting about what winning looks like, what losing looks like, and also sort of messaging about civilian protection, what sort of red flags people should be looking for. It's there's been a lot of focus on this, you know, the impending fight and the advance towards Mosul, but there really has not been much discussion about what people should expect here. And I wonder if that doesn't end up sort of backfiring as you know, people who expect this to be sort of a quickly wrapped up thing, or potentially, you know, very difficult images emerge. You know, the risk of civilian atrocities, considering some of the fractioned groups. I seems like a perilous thing.
I agree with you. I do think this is risky timing for the Obama administration and its legacy, and also for the next administration, because essentially by checking the box on Mosul, assuming that this Mosul campaign actually ends before this administration ends, which is, you know, probably likelier than not, then where does the battle against ISIS shift next? Well, it shifts to Raqqa, which means that the first priority of the next president is to figure out what to do with Syria.
Yeah.
You know, so it's almost like, okay, I'm getting my victory, and then I did the easy part. I'm getting out of town. Now you get to deal with the tough stuff. So I actually think in some ways it's not just not a gift to a likely Clinton administration. It's the opposite.
I actually disagree. I think that I mean, not that I think it's a gift to Clinton, but I actually do think that this is the timing is probably coincidental vis-a-vis the presidential election. The administration has been saying for a long time that they were getting ready to think about the battle for Mosul. It's actually been delayed a fair bit. To me, it's a surprise that it takes place this late, not a surprise that it takes place this early. And I would think it would be a very unfortunate thing if you delayed an operation to relieve literally a million people of ISIS rule, because of the appearance of the presidential election. And I think actually, if you want to fault the Obama administration on this, it makes more sense to fault them for not having gotten their crap together to deal with it this summer, rather than fault them for, you know, handing Hillary a lemon by dealing with Mosul and not Raqqa now.
Although there were definitely a lot of noises being made that this Mosul operation wouldn't take place until after the election, and that the reason it began now is because of pressure from the Iraqi government, that they were mobilized, they had the political agreement of the Shia militias to stay out, and they wanted to go ahead and do it when the timing was ripe on the ground.
But
Obama wanted to delay.
But that's exactly my point. The point is, it would be proper to fault him if given that if given that all the military components were there and the political components with respect to the Iraqi government were there, he had delayed on grounds that, you know, there was an election going on in the United States. That would have been a grotesque impropriety on his part, in my view.
Agreed.
And so I think it's wrong-headed to say, well, okay, but it hands Hillary a sort of a rotten apple. You do these things when they're ready to be done. And if I have a fault for the Obama administration, it's that they didn't get this done earlier, not that they didn't hold it until later.
Okay. Let's move on to our next story. James Cartwright, who was the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, once known as Obama's favorite general for his closeness to the president, pleaded guilty this week to a charge of lying to federal investigators who were trying to find out who leaked information about Stuxnet, a.k.a. the Olympic Games cyber program against Iran's nuclear program, to journalists. Cartwright apparently was shown by investigators a number of quotes from a book by David Sanger of the New York Times and said that he was not the source of those quotes when, in fact, he was. And also lied to investigators about information that he shared with Danny Klaibman, who was at Newsweek/The Daily Beast at the time and working on Iran. So what I found fascinating about this story, and I'm really anxious to hear what you guys think, it's not as if Jim Cartwright, or Haas Cartwright to his friends, I guess, was the only source for Stuxnet. Many people had long assumed that he had talked to David Sanger, that he was a major source for it. It is clear from reading Sanger's book and his coverage that he is not the only person he talked to. And it was generally the understanding that Cartwright was sent out with the blessing in some form of the White House to talk about this program with journalists. And in fact, says in his statement to the public, as does his lawyer, that these stories were already prepared and reported when he engaged the journalists. He was actually engaging in a well-worn practice of trying to stop certain information from getting out. So portrays himself as somebody who was saying, look, I'm going to talk to these journalists, but really to try to find out what they know and correct any misimpressions, which is something that senior administration officials frequently do after reporters have run the traps of their other sources. And yet he's the one who gets charged. And there is, you know, I'm curious what you think, whether this is – is there politics involved here? I mean, Cartwright was a close friend, was a close ally of Obama. He did not have a lot of friends in the Pentagon. He earned the enmity of secretaries of defense and senior generals by going around the chain of command to bring alternative plans about Afghanistan's surge to Obama. He wasn't really seen as a team player in that regard. And there are some who speculate that the knives were kind of always out for Cartwright. And why is he the one who's going down in this 3-year-long leak investigation? And not being charged with leaking, by the way, and when nobody else is being brought forward and charged with actually being the source of information.
So there is a very simple answer to this question, and it is lying to the FBI.
Right. It's not the crime. It's the cover-up.
And
he lied.
There is – I mean, there is no – there is nothing in the world, not child porn, not terrorism, nothing – that the FBI is more likely to insist that you be indicted for than lying to the FBI. And by the way, in the Clinton email, testimony, when Jim Comey was, you know, is asked, you know, he specifically says we never charge people just for mishandling information. There has to be some exacerbating factor, some aggravating factor. One of the aggravating factors he names, lying to the FBI. And, you know, they charge this stuff really consistently. And I'm being a little bit flip in the way I'm describing it and making it sound a little self-interested on their part. But the truth is, it's actually really, I think, justifiable. They can't do their job if people don't engage with investigations in a responsible or reasonable fashion. And if you, as the subject of or a witness in an investigation, don't comport yourself honestly, they will spend years coming after you. So the moral of
the story. In this case, they did. Go ahead, sorry.
So the moral of the story, it's really simple. If you've leaked stuff and the FBI comes knocking at your door, just tell them what you did. And if they ask you, did you talk to Danny Clydman? You just say, Danny Clydman is a guy who can sell you your own underwear. And he sold me mine. And I talked to him. And yes, and if they say, did you tell this thing to David Sanger? Then you say, why, yes. I'm afraid I did say this thing to David Sanger. And look, I think General Cartwright is a very bright guy, and I feel for him, and I actually hope the president pardons him before he leaves office. That said, if I were the FBI, I would have pushed to have this case charged, and I just don't see.
Susan looks like she disagrees with you.
So I totally disagree with you. And I think the proof that this is plainly political is David Petraeus, right? He also lied to the FBI and then was allowed to plead to a misdemeanor, right? Cartwright is forced to plead to a felony. Look, I don't think that this is a politically motivated investigation. It's the opposite of that. It's being investigated and then not having powerful political friends to protect you. And so the investigation sort of running its course.
Isn't there another exacerbating difference in Cartwright's case that this was a leak investigation and Petraeus wasn't leaking to the press? He wasn't. And so,
his biographer was claimed to be a journalist.
Right. But yeah, it wasn't leaking in the sense of, you know, I have government secrets that I'm going to give you so that you can expose
But
he
did.
But it doesn't appear.
Gave her books full of code word stuff.
But the difference, I suppose, in Petraeus's favor, there's a lot of differences in Cartwright's favor here, but the difference in Petraeus's favor is that none of that stuff appears ever to have seen the light of day, and that, you know, whereas this did blow a major, major COVID.
Right,
but this is the part that doesn't sort of make sense in terms of the public, because he confirmed something that was already known. He doesn't appear to be the source of it.
And it's also not clear that he wasn't sent out by the White House to do this or by someone higher up. I mean, or maybe he was doing it under what he thought was his own authority, but there's always been this understanding that Cartwright had some kind of permission to go and talk about this. And maybe he overstepped his bounds in this instance, but like he very clearly says in his statement, I knew I was not the source for this story, but yes, I did lie to the FBI because I didn't want to be blamed for the leak. So.
Right. So look, it's typical for particular individuals within sort of the administration or agencies to be designated as people who have permission to speak to the press. They do so with the understanding that they, you know, are appropriately protecting classified information, right? There's only senior level people that are sort of trusted with that, are allowed to engage in those, exchanges. And it sounds like this is an example of him, going rogue or confirming something he didn't mean to. I think it's sort of, there's a more difficult sort of problem that the administration's in and that the Justice Department's in. And that is that, people have, specifically Petraeus, got off the hook, when he probably shouldn't have. Other people, low-level individuals in the military, certainly other people in the IC have faced very, very serious consequences for, what many people would argue was, less egregious conduct and conduct with the same sort of, where information never ultimately came out. And so there's always sort of, there's been this perception of, hey, there are different rules for different people, right? The rules for the people at the top and rules for people at the bottom. This is sort of egregious that Petraeus got off, sort of scot-free. And actually, we even heard Ash Carter talking about reopening the investigation to potentially,
reduce his rank.
Reduce his rank, right? There's a lot of tension over there. Then, of course, sort of the Hillary Clinton stuff is lumped in with that, although really very different in kind. But if you just kind of take the Cartwright, Petraeus, and low-level people, once you've let Petraeus get off the hook, you have a choice to make, right? You either then let other people get off the hook, because if you punish them, it looks political and unfair, or you say we made a mistake, maybe he should have been more seriously charged, whatever happened, but that's the past, and now we're going to demonstrate our commitment for prosecuting high-level people, because the important thing is is not to perpetuate this idea that what matters is not necessarily political friends, but rank, right? High-level people can get away with anything, low-level people can't. So I think that's why their hands were more tied here, because
they'd already let somebody off too easy, is what you're saying.
Exactly. And if they'd let Cartwright off as well, I think that would have only perpatuated this belief. So it's a hard situation.
So I agree with that. I also think, I mean, look, if you go back to Comey's testimony about the Clinton email stuff, he really objected and it's still pretty raw to what Eric Holder did in the Petraeus case. And, you know, and some of us, you know, I wrote about it at the time that I thought that plea was indefensible. And so, you know, the explanation here may be that that Petraeus reaped a kind of a windfall that Cartwright didn't get the benefit of, but I don't think there's anything surprising or political about the outcome here. You lie to the FBI, they're going to follow you to the ends of the earth.
Well, I think you also raise a really interesting question, Ben, about whether President Obama, now that he's pled guilty and presumably he'll be sentenced in the coming weeks, whether Obama,
January.
Yeah. Whether Obama will then issue a pardon on his way out because he is Obama's favorite general or because he did go out and do this on behalf of the team or, you know, in a Scooter Libby kind of way. Is that the way this is ultimately going to be dealt with? And if that's the case, I think, Susan, it almost compounds the problem you're describing. And so to the extent that the FBI or the Justice Department feels pressure to demonstrate its rigor and even handedness in handling these cases of classified information or of leaks, they still are going to have a problem on their hands.
I just want to say that this actually bolsters the case. If Obama decides he would like to pardon Cartwright, it bolsters the case that Susan and I made a few weeks ago for commuting the sentence of Chelsea Manning, because there's going to be a lot of if he does this, there's a lot of going to be a lot of suggestion that it shows the hypocrisy because he won't pardon Edward Snowden, which he certainly should not do. But if you wanted to soften that and you were advising Obama, you'd say, hey, if you want to pardon Cartwright, there is a clemency that you could do with respect to a lower level leaker that has a lot to say for it. And that's not Snowden, but Chelsea Manning.
Just as a preview, Cartwright is due back in court to be sentenced on January 17th.
Ooh, doesn't so leave a lot of time.
You can do a commutation or a pardon. 3 days. 3 days. All right.
Yeah, you're getting into Cap Weinberger's territory there.
Sure. Yep.
Well, you know, it's we've been down that road before, so we've been in uncharted territory so much. It's so nice to have something familiar laid out before us. All right, let's move on to our next story. Three men in Kansas were arrested and accused of being part of a right-wing group known as the Crusaders and plotting attacks on Muslims in the state of Kansas. Susan, we're not in Kansas. What's going on over there?
And thank God for that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this
What's
is
the matter with Kansas?
I don't know. Apparently,
nothing that a good crusade could fix.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Their failed crusade. Yeah, so this is, you know, it's a very interesting case and an interesting example of domestic terrorism emerging from the far right. Something that a lot of people have alleged that there's sort of insufficient attention given to sort of right wing extremism versus Muslim extremism. So this is it was investigated as a domestic terrorism case. Of course, there is no substantive offense of domestic terrorism under federal law. However, there is, for investigative purposes, there are domestic terrorism. They do investigate domestic terrorism. So this is a sovereign citizen group. They're anti-government, they're anti-Muslim, and sort of anti-extremist generally. They are located in a town ironically called Liberal Kansas.
I bet they love that.
And these three men, Patrick Stein, Curtis Allen, and Gavin Wright, essentially plotted to blow up a building that housed both a mosque and where many Muslim immigrants from the Somali community lived. Sort of clearly, you know, a hate crime. You know, had plotted the target, had surveilled it, sort of had taken those really ominous, substantial steps before the FBI intervened.
And they wanted to do it the day after Election Day, right? So they clearly tied it to this political campaign.
And they were specifically, you know, what they were plotting to do is, you know, particularly scary. They were plotting multiple bombs built on the Tim McVeigh fertilizer model planted at different corners of this set of facilities. And so you could have imagined it being a very significant mass casualty event.
Right. So absolutely, I think it's this is the FBI deserves and the Joint Terrorism Task Force deserves a lot of credit for saving probably hundreds of lives. The thing that's sort of interesting about this case, not just because it validates some of the fears about the campaign rhetoric and sort of the outgrowth of violent Islamophobia in general, but also that the FBI used investigative methods here that are considered contrary controversial in investigating terrorism related to foreign terrorist organizations or sort of Islamic terrorism. I guess that's the magic word people want to hear now. They used a paid confidential informant. Had consensual wiretapping, right? So the source agrees to be wiretapped. They essentially ran an informant against them. So this is something that has gotten a lot of criticism in the past, just sort of as infiltrating communities, potentially leading to entrapment. These people are not reliable, and sort of there's in particular, sort of civil liberties organizations really criticize this technique. It clearly was incredibly successful in this case. So it is interesting to sort of hear crickets from or even the same groups that condemn this activity with certain groups lauding it here.
Is there anything in the indictment that suggests entrapment or inappropriate encouragement? I mean, it seems to me one reason why maybe we're hearing crickets is because this is egregious. I mean, the planning and the conduct that's described here is egregious. So it's not one of these borderline cases where maybe they would have just been a talk shop, but for the FBI.
No, but Susan's point is very important that, you know, these are tactics that are often the bread and butter stuff of successful law enforcement operations in a counterterrorism context. And they've come into disrepute in certain communities because it's assumed that they are sort of deployed in an unfair way against Muslim communities. And this is a case where they are deployed in very much the same way to protect a Muslim community from scary white people.
Well, look,
I want to say one of the most moving things about this story is that the Somali community in question had a demonstration with American flags and to thank law enforcement for protecting them. And, you know, I think the story has just not gotten enough coverage for a lot of reasons, but one of them is the point that Susan makes, that this is, you know, this is the violent extremist end of a lot of the rhetoric that, you know, some of our political leadership is using these days. And when you stoke the alt-right world, this is the corner of it that, you know, to use the language that people use about Muslims a lot of the time, and I think justifiably so sometimes, you know, radicalizes and we have to think about this in the language of, you know, countering violent extremism. But the other reason is exactly the point that Susan makes in the other direction, which is that these tools are important for investigating violent groups irrespective of their orientations. And in a world in which, a political world in which, you know, going after Muslims is politically acceptable, we're going to see a lot more of this, and law enforcement is going to need the tools to do this, just as it needs the tools to go after, you know, ISIS sympathizing self-radicalizers.
One thing that I'm sort of surprised is that this, in terms of the lack of media coverage, is that this hasn't been more directly tied to Donald Trump's campaign. We're on track for, I guess, the worst year on record in terms of Islamophobic violence. There were 78 mosque attacks in 2015. We're on track to pass that. And just reading this, UC Berkeley tracks with care the number of anti-Muslim violence, and they noted that not only incidents in 2015 tripled in compared to the past 2 years, and in November and December of 2015 there were 17 mosque incidents during each of those months, numbers almost equivalent to the entire year's worth of reports. So clearly sort of directly tracking to the rise of Donald Trump, sort of the most hateful elements of his campaign. One of the things that's included in this indictment is a conversation in which one of the alleged perpetrators says, make sure you start using your bows on them cockroaches being the Muslims, make sure you dip them in pig's blood before you shoot them. This is a direct reference to, of course, the myth about General Pershing dipping bullets in pig's blood before shooting Muslims, strongly identified with racist themes, picked up by Donald Trump in sort of in a very bizarre way. There are so the indicia here that these people were inspired by the rhetoric and really were plotting an incredible act of violence timed for right after the election. The fact that that has sort of nobody's really keying into that, I'm really surprised.
Well, yeah, violent acts that don't happen, you know, never acquire the same salience as the ones that do.
And especially violent acts. Like, after the Oklahoma City bombing, there was a lot of news coverage of all kinds of right-wing extremist activity in the United States. If there had been some kind of attack, you know, then everything after that would get more coverage. But because we haven't seen any of that in a while in the United States, thank goodness, it just falls into that dog that didn't bark category that Ben just described. But, you know, honestly, I don't think the FBI would have to, use all of these, you know, informants and wiretapping and these controversial tactics if the crusaders would just report when they hear.
Exactly.
You know,
Christian communities have got to be looking among their ranks.
Yeah. And they should report.
I could not agree more.
Hashtag Christians report.
And yes. As a Christian, I apologize on behalf of these men. It's just, it's outrageous.
All right. Let's move on to object lessons. I'll go first. My object is actually, it's sort of an update to a story we talked about on the podcast before, that Susan talked a lot about this company Muddy Waters, which I just thought was one of my favorite names for a company ever, this investment company, all year long. Right. Basically shorted, correct me if I'm wrong in retelling the story, Susan, but shorted stock along with another group in St. Jude, the medical device manufacturer, and then publicized the security vulnerabilities that St. Jude's, they said, had in its products in order to drive the stock down and then profit from it and also to get St. Jude's to fix its profits. St. Jude's retaliated by filing a lawsuit against Muddy Waters, MedSec, and other companies, as well as three executives at the firm, alleging that they were sending out disseminating false and misleading information about some of its products, including a pacemaker, to which Muddy Waters and MedSec have now started a website called Profits Over Patients. It says, come to profitsoverpatients.com for updates to our defense against St. Jude Medical's attempt to sweep revelations about its extremely poor cybersecurity under the rug through a lawsuit, and then proceeds to show videos on how they actually hacked the devices. Which is sort of a
videos like watch as we stop this guy's heart.
Well,
like,
watch as we hit this device. I mean, these are videos. One is called like emergency shock, where they hack into the device, as you can see right here, and sort of show how they did it, or at least claim to show how they did
it. Can I do that to my teenager if he won't get out of bed in the morning?
Sure.
Like, send an emergency shock?
Sure you can.
Well, that's one way to gin up some sympathy.
Yeah. So they're taking it. Profitsoverpatients.com.
Wow.
That's excellent. As I said when you raised this issue on a previous show, I totally support this as a cybersecurity mechanism. If people can profit by shorting stocks of companies that are not responding to cybersecurity incidents and then embarrassing them, I say God bless. And
see, but I think that your statement reveals the ill-conceived nature of profits over patients, because of course I think the profits they mean to refer to are the profits of St. Jude's for not fixing it. But what right. It actually sounds like is, of course, that they also have profited. So
they want to, don't they?
Instead of a charge, it seems like a rallying cry. Well, profits over patients.
So I assume that they were imputing that attitude to St. Jude's. But I just think it's a creative approach to financing cybersecurity. And I think there are probably a lot of people with these particular pacemakers who would benefit from St. Jude's squirming a little bit and feeling like the fire was turned up on under their asses to fix this problem quickly. And if somebody can profit by holding their feet to that particular fire, I got no problem with that.
There we go. I have an object lesson
okay.
as well.
Okay.
So my object lesson is a picture that I took this weekend in the old executive office building at the White House. It's, I guess, the Eisenhower building now, we're supposed to call it. So I have a friend who is leaving the administration, and after refusing to give anyone a West Wing tour, of course, the East Wing tours are public. The West Wing tour, you have to know someone.
They didn't give a tour?
They said you can get a West Wing tour. You cannot get a public West Wing
tour.
I was
saying your friend didn't give a tour.
Oh, well, not before, but she did this weekend.
Oh,
so she's
waited until the end.
I sort of understand, right? Otherwise, she would have been a full-time tour guide. So we did get to go, see the Oval Office and the Roosevelt Room and all this sort of, it was very fun and neat to see all of that. But the old Executive Office Building, which is just an absolutely stunning,
one of the best buildings in Washington.
It's much better than sort of than the actual West Wing itself. I mean, just these
architecturally, just beautiful.
And all of the little sort of statues and details and furniture,
the
and
molding, the mantelpieces,
the skylights. I mean, it really is
mansard
like
a
beautiful museum. And all gender bathrooms. I also took a picture of the all gender bathroom sign at the OEO. So
thanks, Obama.
Thanks, Obama. So that is my object lesson. Is the
The beautiful
OEO. OEO.
So I've got an object lesson that wasn't, which is, you know, listeners of Rational Security know that I have purchased a device to enable myself to throw fireballs. And since I debuted
because you are insane.
And since I debuted this device on Rational Security, I have used it in a variety of contexts. I threw a fireball to introduce a guest speaker to my Georgetown class. And I've practiced with it a lot, and I've gotten used to throwing fireballs. And I was giving on a panel today at New America, and I thought this was the day that I was going to launch a fireball from the dais in a think tank panel.
Yeah. Because that's what the world needs.
Because that's what the world needs, was a fireball. And I even had the perfect,
wasn't it a counterterrorism panel?
It was a rule of law and counterterrorism foundations panel. And I had the perfect moment in the speech planned out to do it, which was that I was going to tell the story of, my former research assistant, Cody Poplin, who had on his door a New Yorker cartoon of the Constitutional Convention, where the founders are standing around, and the caption reads, "And of course, we should give the executive branch the authority to rain death from the skies." And as I said, from the skies, rain death from the skies. I was going to launch a fireball, and it all went beautifully, except that the fireball launcher didn't work.
Lame.
And so we got to and rain death from the skies, and I must have looked like an idiot, threw my hand out like I was throwing a fireball. No fireball emerged. And so I went on with the speech.
Did you acknowledge, hey guys, there was supposed to be a fireball?
No, because since nobody's expecting a fireball when you give a speech at a think tank, that would have required so much explanation that actually I'm wearing a fireball
Ben's
thrower.
6-word memoir, for sale, fireball. Never fired.
And so there will come a time when the first fireball launched from the dais at a think tank panel will happen in Washington.
But not today.
But not today. It will not be this day.
We probably picked a good place to do it. Probably about half the New America audience would have gotten a kick out of it.
Yeah. I think, that's so high tech.
And the annoying thing is that right afterwards, I walked out with a friend. We were going to lunch afterwards, and I had this loaded fireball thrower on my wrist, and I was like, all right, I got to empty this thing, and I pushed the button again and went, and I did it, and launched them both. It scared the crap out of a woman who was walking down the street next to me. But
that's your consolation prize, Ben.
The moment, it was a total fireball fail, which should be a hashtag, by the way.
Oh, fireball fail. Well, next time, Ben. There'll be other times.
Yeah.
And it's probably best that you didn't give it away because they might not have you back. All right, that brings us to the end of the podcast. Rational Security is a production of Spaghetti on the Wall Productions. You can find our show archive at spaghettionthewallproductions.com. You can follow us on Twitter at @RATLSecurity. If you download the podcast from iTunes or Stitcher or your other favorite podcatcher, please remember to leave a rating and a review. It really helps us out and helps other people find the podcast as well. Our audio engineer is Quinta Jurassic. The podcast is produced and edited by Jen Howell. Our music was performed this week by Melania Trump and the Bully Riggers.
Oh.
Somehow, like...
Bully.
And I get it. Anything with Melania Trump is almost by definition not funny.
Yeah.
She just stands in the front and just kind of vamps and just pouts.
Yeah.
And turns side to side.
She is a humorless person, if ever there was one.
Yeah.
And she believes her husband.
She may be the last one in America. Of course, our music is performed as always by Sophia Yan, who is bullying her all the best ways.
Yep.
And rigs nothing. That piano playing is all her.
It's all real.
On behalf of my friends, Tamara Kaufman Wittes, Ben Wittes, Sans Fireball, and Susan Hennessy, I'm Shane Harris. We'll talk to you next week. Enjoy the debate.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.